All right, y'all. Good to see everybody tonight. Welcome to Dharma Live Online. And we'll have a talk and a meditation and a discussion as usual. So just to dig right in, for those of you who were here last week, I talked a lot about attention, the role of attention, the ability to train our attention, and really pointing out that the most fundamental, the most fundamental activity that we do in any form of meditation, Dharma practice, is dealing with the reality of attention. So you can listen to that talk again if you missed it. And where to go from here, we talked about concentration for a while. I thought tonight I would just, because we're dealing with attention, and attention is known as a universal mental factor. And what that means is that attention is in every moment. You'll never find a moment without attention. So I thought what I would do is I would go through basically just constructing for you all for the next couple of weeks of what the mind is, because we hear a lot about this word mind, mindfulness. To some degree, I think most of us recognize that when we're practicing meditation or we're developing mindfulness, the thing we're dealing with is our mind. And so I'm going to unpack that. Mostly I'm going to pull from the Buddhist discourses that are known in the Abhidharma, because they're contextualized and categorized with great detail and great precision. And all of the stuff that's in the Abhidharma is stuff that's also found in the Pali Canon, particularly in this conversation around the mind, but it's better organized. So just to say this, I've probably said this before, but I think we just have to realize this word mind as we know it, in the last 100-150 years, has really undergone a radical psychologization. And what I mean by that is, when we talk about the mind, we're mostly just talking about our internal private experience, our psychological experience, our thoughts, our memories, our feelings, and we've kind of narrowed it down, I think, is what has happened. And there's been some benefits of that and probably some drawbacks as well. But when the Buddha's talking about the mind, the word that he would probably equate to is what you're experiencing is the mind. So experience, this word experience, I wish it was a Pali correlate for the word experience, because I think it's a great English word. We use it a lot. I use it all the time. And so what you're, you know, you probably, you think that you're experiencing sight and sound and taste and color, and you're experiencing the world, and you're experiencing yourself, and you're experiencing all these things. But really the that's all filtered through what we call the mind. And so, good thing to know about the mind is the mind is trainable. The mind is not this like janky contraption that you just kind of were born into and you just kind of have to learn how to deal with and tolerate. I know you probably feel that way. I feel that way much of the time. But the mind can be trained. The mind is neuroplastic, as they say. It's malleable. It's adaptable. It's really quite a fabulous thing, actually, although most of us would probably find that when we talk about our minds, we mostly complain about it. And I include myself in that as well. So the mind also, we have to realize too, from early Buddhist psychology, and it's important to know this, the mind is not a thing that exists, okay? It's not this contraption again, this like, the mind is not a thing that exists. The mind is an event that occurs. So the mind is a process. The mind is actually a verb, not a noun. The mind is not a person, place, or thing. It's not a thing. It's a state of being. It's a quality of awareness. It's what we take in. We feel about it. We perceive about it. We make memories about it. We make plans about it. So when we're doing mindfulness, or really actually more like Vipassana, which is where all this stuff really comes from, actually, is what we're doing in Vipassana is we're trying to understand and recognize some key features of the mind experience. And the first one that you probably read, or the first one that you've heard about, that's probably on the first page of any Dharma book, is what the Buddha's saying is all things are impermanent. So the mind is constantly changing. You can't pin the damn thing down. Right? So the mind, or the present moment, we always say, I don't like this word present moment because I don't believe such a thing exists. But the experience, mind is moving. We call that time. But time isn't real. We just made that shit up, and conventionally it works really great. Y'all showed up at 7 o'clock. Here we are. Time's useful, but it's not real. what's really going on is things are constantly changing and changing and changing. And we experience what we would call stream of consciousness. So the mind has a kind of stream, a movement to it. It's a verbal form. So that's really what we're experiencing. And we're experiencing the mind through the six sensory experiences, the five basic senses you learned in kindergarten, in the mental mind object sense. So we try to see that all things are changing. The mind is an ever-changing experience. The mind is also what's known as dukkha. The mind is the mind experience is largely pretty unsatisfying. There's nothing in the mind that you can have or get, hold on to, that's going to create a permanent sense of happiness, a stable sense of self. Because it's moving, it's actually pretty unreliable. And it's contingent upon a lot of things, and it's you know, and we have to deal with that, and we don't like that. You know, if you look at, you know, early childhood psychology, clinically speaking, one of the things that people have a hard time dealing with is change and unreliability. And so that's something that never stops, that we really, you know, what can you rely on? You can rely on change. That's about it. That's going to happen. So that the mind is dukkha. The mind is, it's not perfect. It's not, you know, and it's not finished, and on it goes. So when you were, you know, if you had a good day yesterday and you were happy about your life yesterday, well, that was yesterday. How do you feel right now? You can't really get or have anything, which is, I know, kind of irritating, but you can't. All you have is experience. Rising and passing away in every single moment. The mind is also anatta, which the mind is not self. You are not your mind, and your mind is not you. Although your mind is probably often telling you that, no, I'm pretty sure I'm me. That's what my mind says. My mind is pretty convinced it is this character called Dave Smith, and has different feelings about the experience and the project of this Dave Smith character. And I have a whole range of mixed feelings about how that's going, as I'm sure you do as well. So it takes on. So when we do Vipassana, the Vipassana movement and the Vipassana teachings is trying to say, you want to keep these things in mind, because you don't want to, if you don't see these things or acknowledge these things, what you'll do is you'll cling on to things. So that's kind of the experience that we're in. That's the territory. I actually kind of think about it as our environment. You know, I think I live in Colorado, you live wherever you think you live, but really where you live, ground zero, let's be honest, ground zero is your mind. That is where you live. And it would probably be in your best interest, if that's the primary experience, if that's the primary place in which we dwell, that's probably the part of our experience we want to clean up or get together or understand or relate to. And you know, and the theory is, of course, if you change your mind, you change your world. So the other thing to say about Indian philosophy or Indian worldview, ancient Indian anyway, is we think of the world as that which is really out there, right? We think of the world, and that's what's out there is called the world. They didn't think about it that way, actually. They thought about it more from inside out, that the world, that which is really out there, is actually created by an internal experience, which is actually more accurate. When you think about neuroscience, you start thinking about how perception works, and apperception is that we, you know, there is that which is really out there, no doubt, but largely it's created from internal experience, or it's filtered through that. So, you know, you want to change, you know, change your world, change your mind, get going on that project first, because that's actually something you also can do. You can't control or change much of the world, although we try. But we really can work on ourselves. And I think that's really the core aspect of what the Buddha's saying. He's like, you can work on your mind, and that's really what you should, if you're working on anything, that's what you should be working on. In the early discourses in the Suttinipata, which is the oldest part of the Pali Canon, where the Buddha makes a lot of analogies to secular life, actually, he says, just as a fletcher fashions an arrow, and just as a farmer irrigates a field, and just as a woodworker shapes the piece of wood just how he would like, the practitioner shapes the mind. So what he's saying is the practitioner, the cultivator, us, what we're doing is we're trying to shape and to mold and to form the mind into how we would like it to be. And this is largely done through meditation, but also through the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, which is how we interact with the world, that which is really out there. I hope that makes sense. I think that's an interesting way to look at it, because we don't think about, generally speaking, most people don't think about the mind along these lines. And I've actually gotten a lot of freedom thinking about it this way, because what it does is it allows me to relate to my experience in a more way that's more intelligent. There's actually a teacher named Akinchen O. Weber. If you ever get a chance, if you ever go on Dharma Seed, check out Akinchen O. Weber, because he's outstanding. He's a Swedish teacher. He was a Theravada monk and a Zen monk, I think, for quite some time. And his English isn't his first language, but his English is insanely precise. His choice of words and his word usage and his diction is actually spectacular. It's almost it's impressive. And he really talks about Dharma practice as developing an intelligent relationship to our experience. And I think that's safe to say, or even an emotionally intelligent relationship to our experience, not a relationship to myself or my world or my mom or my dad or politics or society, but a relationship to my experience. So let's unpack what that actually means. So when we look at the operating system, the most basic system of the mind, we basically have five things. And so the first one, what are called universal mental factors in the Abhidharma. They're things that are in every moment, and they're the building block. They're kind of the bricks and mortar of consciousness or mind. And the first two that we can talk about is one, attention, which the Pali term is manasikara, which means to make in the mind. So whatever I pay attention to, the mind resembles that. If I look at a tree, I see the tree out there, and it just gives me the same thing here and there. So what I'm paying attention to, sounds, everything, the mind will resemble what it pays attention to. And this is largely how conditioning works. If we grew up in a dangerous household and all we're doing is paying attention to how dangerous it is, then we feel the world is a dangerous place, and we live in fear and we live on uncertainty, and the mind resembles that which it takes on, which undoing conditioning, a lot of the stuff we do in Dharma practice is, let's be honest, fairly excruciating because of that reality. So we have attention in this other word, which is contact, which is a good word. Contact is paso. So contact and attention. So every time attention makes contact with a sound, with a smell, with a taste, with a thought. So what happens is attention is always colliding with an object, right? So we trained attention by putting the attention on the sensations of the in-breath. So we have contact with the in-breath. We stay with that. We make contact with that contact and attention. Right, that's really what's going on in every single moment. And because of that, because there's a kind of a collision, there's this mind experience and then there's an object colliding with each other, that actually creates a bit of stress, because the mind is always doing that. That's always happening. So that's an activity that is just ever going. We're always making contact with something. And so what we're trying to do when the training the attention, as I talked about last week, we're trying to learn how to keep the attention on one particular object or a few objects, so we can cool down the mental proliferation, the thinking, the planning, the remembering, all those activities, which I'll talk about those in a second. So we have contact and attention. They collide. And what happens, what that does is that triggers another mental factor. That triggers what's called Vedana, which is feeling. So everything that attention makes contact with also has a feeling. So feeling, Vedana, which is also the second foundation of mindfulness, is in every moment. You'll never find a moment absent of feeling. And if you do kind of think or reflect that the moment is, there's no feeling, then that would be indifference or neutrality. It's just that the absence of pleasure and pain. So every sound, every sight, every taste, every color, every sensation, every thought, even thoughts, as you can imagine, come with this characteristic of contact, attention, and then feeling. So we are feeling beings, which really is another way to say that we're really, really sensitive. We're sentient. Sentient means that we're of a sensory experience. And all of our sensory experience comes with Vedana, feeling. So we have contact and attention, and then feeling arises out of that. And then another thing gets triggered here, not just this, it's more and more elaborate. We make contact with experience. We have this feeling tone that arises. And then another experience arises, which is, we could talk about forever, is known as perception, is the way it's translated. And that's probably a pretty good translation. The Pali term is sanya. Sanya means to perceive. And all these words have this suffix at the end of them, nna. And nna in Pali grammatical terms means nya. It means to know. So when you see this word nya, so vedana is about, so we know how we feel. Sanya, we know what we're perceiving. And perception is one of these things that's really, really, really simple and totally complicated at the same time. Perception is just how you, like, you know, let me see if I can find something obvious. I hold this up. You know that this is a pen. You perceive this as a pen. Your mind just says pen. You probably know that this is a lighter, you know, and you just, so what it is, it's the mind, it knows things through learning. So the way that we perceive experience. So the world is intelligent to us. We can easily differentiate a sound from a taste, from a thought. We have all this differential knowledge, perception, which is really, are also known as apperception, is a really sophisticated, it's a huge dimension of the mind experience. It's really actually kind of psychedelic almost. Now, the problem with perception, among many problems with perception, is that on one hand, it's highly, highly, predictable and very, very accurate. And on another hand, it's completely unpredictable and totally inaccurate. For example, depth perception. Now, I drive my truck mostly every day, and I'm able to see in front of me and see the objects coming, and I never hit anything. I don't think I've ever hit anything. I'm able to navigate my way through the world. I'm able to do a lot of things with my physical perception. And what that creates is, it creates the delusion that my perceiving mechanism is in fact accurate. But what if somebody gives me a dirty look in public? You know, and I perceive that, well, this person doesn't like me. This person's, you know, kind of an asshole or whatever. Like, I don't know that. That's totally inaccurate. How I perceive myself, self-perception, is insanely inaccurate. How you perceive yourself. I perceive myself a million different ways, a million times a day. And a lot of the way that I perceive myself is based on how I feel. So if I wake up in the morning and I didn't get a lot of sleep, and I had to let my dogs out a couple times because they were barking, and I wake up and I'm a little bit grumpy, Dave Smith thing kind of blows, and I don't really like it. And the perception of myself is, you know, I'm lazy. I don't get enough of sleep. I don't follow through with things. And, you know, I made bad choices, which is why I, you know, all this shit. Or I could get lots of sleep and I can wake up good, and I wake up and I have energy and I'm in a good mood, and the sun's out, and I think, oh, Dave Smith is a great experience. I'm so happy to be here. And that's all just based on perception and feeling. That's not rooted in anything. And so a lot of the way that we perceive about ourselves is moment to moment, dependent on how we feel and also the emotional undertone that might be happening. Does that make sense? Like, notice when you're in a good mood, you're not mean to yourself. Also, you notice if you're in a good mood, you're likely not to be mean to other people, or short or curt or kind of a little bit shitty. You don't generally do that when we're in a good mood, unless we're like a sociopath a little bit. But when I'm tired or grumpy, or when I'm actually hurting a little bit, I tend to be a little bit not so kind all the time. And that's not just some random event. That is based on how I feel. It's based on how I'm perceiving things, how I'm perceiving myself, how I'm perceiving the situation. So all of these experiences are all interdependent. They're not causal. Okay. It's not like contact, attention, feeling, perception. They're not linear. They all arise at the same time. They arise and they pass away, and they arise and they pass away. So when you look at the mind, you make contact with attention makes contact with something. You have a feeling, And then you also have a perception about that. And that really forms a lot of things. But one of the things that people get into, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is people believe their perception. The information that their mind is giving them in the present moment, they take that as truth. And that's where we get in a lot of trouble around fixed views. So we start believing that however we're perceiving a situation is actually accurate and true and real. And it's how it is. And we get fixed. This is what the Buddha is saying to right out of the gate. This is our primary problem, actually, is a misperception of ourself and other in reality. And then the way that we buy into that and we believe into that and we create a worldview and a self view and we make all these assessments and appraisals of situations. And it's mostly just the best information your mind gave you at that particular moment. It's almost like an endless, bottomless social media news feed. And every moment you're just getting a little hit of data. And how much of the data that scrolls through your mind is fucking helpful or true or useful? Sorry, not so much of it. And so mindfulness, sati, as a mental factor, would look at this, would look at what I'm paying attention to, what I'm making contact with, how I feel about it, how I perceive it, and say, okay, like, how do we want to relate to this? You know, how do I want to be in this experience? Do I just want to believe everything that, do I want to question? Do I want to reappraise? Do I want to reevaluate? So the power of mindfulness, just in its ability to alter or to reorganize perception, is super profound. In fact, there's a whole book on it. I used to have it on my website, but I just updated my website. But if you email me, I'll send it to you. This book, Mindfulness in Early Buddhism, it's an academic book by Seifu Kwan. I have a PDF version. If you want, I'll send it to you. Don't buy it. It's like $100. These academic Dharma books are wicked expensive. But his whole premise, it's a PhD thesis, is that the whole role of mindfulness, sati, is to reorganize our perception of ourselves in the world and others so that A, it's more accurate and also more caring, more kind, more benevolent. And that's the whole, what he's saying is that's really what mindfulness does. Although we're not done yet. We have actually two more things. So the next one's really hard to talk about. So we make contact with the present moment, with an object in the present moment. We feel a certain way about it, or we feel pleasing. We feel drawn towards the object. We feel resistant towards the object. We perceive the object. We kind of know what's going on. Like, even when you're confused, mostly in your life, you move through the day, you kind of know what's going on for the most part. And then there's this, it triggers this other thing, which is called sankhara, which is a tricky, it's a puzzle term in Pali, which means it's one of these terms that nobody really knows what it means. It's usually, in 90% of Dharma books, it's translated as mental formations, which I think is very unhelpful, and kind of a really bad translation. Stephen Batchelor and Ajahn Sachito translate it as inclination. So based on what I'm making contact with and how I feel and how I perceive, I'm inclined to do something about it. Okay. Inclinations, choice, determinations. The word that I would use, and my friend, one of my teachers who I really love and respect, named John Peacock, who's a Buddhist scholar, him and I both like this word habit or habituation. So, and the word habit's good because everybody knows what this word habit is. We all know about habits, and you could go interview anybody. You could go interview people coming out of the local Walmart and they could tell you about all kinds of habits. And most people know that there's good habits and there's bad habits. And we want to encourage our good habits and we want to overcome our bad habits. Everybody sort of knows that. But habituation. So I make contact with my experience. I'm paying attention to contact. I feel a certain way. I have feelings about it. I'm perceiving it. It's intelligent. I kind of understand what's going on. And then sankhara is not nya. It's not about knowing. It's about to do. So this is the big part of the mind that gets us in a lot of trouble. This is the factor of the mind that is the to-do quality. Do you have to-do in your mind? How many moments is your mind telling you to do something or to not do something? Do this, don't do that. Well, you better do this. You didn't do this yesterday. You better do it today. Well, I'll just do it tomorrow. No, I wouldn't wait till tomorrow. You should probably take care of that right now. I don't feel like taking care of that right now. I'm going to do this other thing. Okay, I'm going to do that. The mind, I don't know about you, but my mind is bombarded and littered with this sense of do, better do, got to do, should do, need to do, have to do, why to do, all that do-do. Right? That's basically what it is. And that's all sankhara. That's habituation. So based on how I've behaved in the past, based on how I felt and how I've perceived things, I develop behaviors. And what the Buddha is saying, and this I think is very important, is that thinking, mental proliferation, is actually a behavior. I think it's very important to see thinking as a behavior, psychological behavior, planning, worrying, criticizing, judging, embellishing. All these things are, they're aspects of thinking, and they're all sankharic. They're all habit learned. And this is really, I would say, when we're dealing with the mind, really, this is the bitch of the bunch. This thing is like the thing that really gets us in big trouble. And it's just, sometimes it feels like it's almost relentless, right? This sankhara thing. And actually, the interesting thing, if you look at one of the definitions of nibbana, the third noble truth, as it's usually correlated to, you know, I don't like this word noble truth, but we're stuck with it, I suspect, is the Buddha describes it as the stilling of all formations, but really the stilling of all sankharas. So when the mind is not bombarded with do, 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 there's a non-reactive state. That's down. There's still attention, feeling, and perception, but there's also nibbana. You're not being bullied or dictated or yanked around by this tendency to want to do. And so in many ways, that is the hard work of developing mindfulness, is trying to cool that bugger down, the sankhara. And then the last one, which I don't have to say much about, the last one is which it goes back to a knowing thing. It's vijnana, nya again. See that nya again? It's consciousness. Vijnana is consciousness. So consciousness can be aware of all these different things. I can be conscious or mindful of what I'm paying attention to, what I'm making contact with, how I feel about it, what my perception or my attitude or my stance is about it, what I think I need to do about it. I can be aware of all these things. Now, the interesting thing, and I always look for pushback on this, and I never, is there's no other, everything is happening within one of these five experiences. There's nothing else. That's it. There's attention, there's contact, there's feeling, there's perception, there's habit, and there's consciousness. Everything that happens in your experience, everything that has happened in your life would fit very completely into one or many of those categories. So this is basically the OS. This is the operating system. Really all there is. You know, even a memory. Well, what about memories? Well, memories is just an aspect of perception. It's a stamp I've taken, it's a picture I've taken about the past. And I have different feelings about all my memories. So you can really get, and I'll do a meditation on this. We'll go through these actually. And again, like I said last week, I don't want you to think about this so much as a meditation, but I'd like you to think about this more as a kind of psychological experiment that we're going to conduct to see if you can agree, or to see if you can back up, or if I can back up everything I just told you. Like, is that really what's happening here? And that's one thing I love about this, the Buddhist psychology, is that I found this to be all there is. And a lot of times when I get worked up in my life, which is almost every day, what I can do is I can run through these and I go, okay, well, I'll look at a situation that I'm upset. I'll go, well, what's the perception? Well, the perception is this person didn't do what they were supposed to do, and this fucking person never does what they're supposed to do, and people don't do what they're supposed to do, and the world is unfair, and yada, yada. I'm like, okay, that's one way to look at it. Is there... You know, and then how do I feel? I feel really unpleasant, and I feel really entitled, and I feel really like in a rush, and I feel like this shit needs to happen 5 minutes ago. Okay, that's what's going on, and then I can back away from that habituation. Well, what am I going to do about this? Usually, to be honest with you, most of the time what works is I shouldn't do anything about it. I should just not do anything. I should just cool my jets. And stop trying to fix or change or avoid or control everything. Because those are the key elements of the sankharic tendency of the mind. It wants to fix things, it wants to change things, and it wants to avoid things. And if it can't do any of those three, it's damn well going to try to control them. You know, and I think that, you know, my habits, probably those are the only four, those are all four destructive habits that I have. And there's a lot going on there. Right? And so maybe, oh, I can't fix it. Okay, all right, that's fine. I can't change it. Okay. I don't think I can avoid it. And if those three are true, you damn well best believe I ain't going to be able to control it. Although, I certainly will try. You know? And all that those are all features of tanha, second noble truth territory, reactivity. Those are the big reactions. So what we do is we react to feelings and perceptions and habits, and we aren't able to embrace, we aren't able to feel into what we're paying attention to and how it's affecting us and what the contact is. And Vedana is about having effective intelligence. Can I feel the discomfort? Can I feel the reactivity arising? And can I not react or act on it? Because what react is, reactivity just means reactivated. So a reaction is just an action that I've done before. Reactivity is, if you break it up, is re-active, reactivate. And we use that word a lot in trauma work. I get activated. So what happens is some habit of mind gets reactivated. It's never worked before. Fixing, changing, avoiding, and controlling has never worked before. But you know what? I'm going to give it another shot right now. Let's give that another go. Maybe it will work this time. But usually we're so caught up, the feeling is so intense, probably unpleasant, that we have a hard time becoming nibbanic in that. We have a hard time cooling our jets in that, because that habituation is so strong that we say the thing, we do the thing, we react. We act in a way that we've done previously. And that's what habituation is. Habituation is, you know, the mind, you know, when we're upset, the mind has a little drop down menu of fix, void, change, or control, and it just selects one of those items and gives it a go. Or we're mindful and we're present and we have some degree of kindness and ease, and we say, okay, like, not that, what else? And usually and honestly, what I find, what else is don't do a goddamn thing. Just hang in there, wait, watch. And that is the greatest skill of all. Very nibbonic, very watching things change, watching things come and go. And that's largely what we do when we sit, is we train ourselves to be able to do that. In sixth grade science terms, all that is training yourself to be homeostatic, which means that your system is regulating optimally, the respiratory system, your heart rate, all your vital signs, right? The system is regulating, the emotion is regulated, you're running optimally. And when you're homeostatic or nibbonic, we do really good. We make good choices. We're able to move through the world with more ease. We're able to have access to our intelligence, and we're able to make more sophisticated choices. We're able to see beyond black and white. We can see things. We can see the gestalt of things. We can see, well, there's actually two things that are true right now that seem to be in opposition of each other. That's okay. And in some ways, we would call that right view. Or if now we're having a perspective on the situation in which we find ourselves that feels like there's possibilities, like we could be creative, like there's alternatives, there's adaptability, there's all these new behaviors that I could select, right? And, you know, you're going to have to work your ass off for this. This is not just going to, you're not just going to do this from now on because I said all of this, right? You're like, well, that sounds great. I'll just do that from now on. That's not how it's going to work.